Gentas presents The Loyalists by Vivian Stewart, performed by Simon Slater. 1. 1900. Chapter 1. The Aborigines, having no calendar, regarded the first day of a new year and even the first day of a new century as just another day. Their ceremonies for newness had to do with season, not a printed number on a paper hanging on the wall. Tolo Mason spent the morning of January the 1st, 1900, helping the stockmen move a small drove of cattle to better grass. With the cattle in the new pasturage, he rode back to the house. His first personal experience with death had come to him at the station. He had never forgotten the sight of the Aboriginal girl, Daringa, lying on the straw-littered floor of a barn. He carried in his mind a permanent picture of her in death, her neck broken and her features twisted. Soon afterward, he had watched the painful wasting demise of his tutor, Dan de Lozenette, another type of death, and one that aroused in him questions that continued to this day. The loss of his father had at first been more of an abstraction than either of the two deaths he had witnessed previously. He had not been able to believe the news of the cablegram, the cold words printed on paper. He had experienced no feeling of loss, only a numbness, which was denial. It could not be, he had felt. John Mason was too real, too vital, too much a part of his life to be dead. John was there, somewhere in England or on the sea, alive, and coming back to his wife and his son and the land that he had come to love. When John did come home in a sealed coffin, the fact became a bit more real for Tolo, but it was only at the funeral itself that his tears came, the ceremony bringing to the surface all the pain and rage of his loss. Reaching the house, he dismounted and gave over his horse to an Abbo boy, beat the dust from his trousers with his floppy-brimmed bush hat and entered. The front rooms were insulated against the day's heat by closed draperies. Thus they retained a residual of the night's coolness. He heard the clatter of pans from the kitchen, pressed on to see that the door to his father's office was open. Misa was at the desk, her dark hair drawn into a loose bun, dressed in black for mourning, as convention required, but in a frock so well tailored that it seemed almost as if she had chosen it expressly for John, who had always enjoyed seeing her well and expensively dressed. "Ah," she said as her son appeared at the door, "you've come at a good time. I was going to send for you." Tolo sat down, crossing his long legs. He knew that she had been spending many hours in the office in the past few days. "I gave you a copy of your father's will the other day," she said. "Did you read it?" He made a face. He had not read the document. Misa laughed. "Your lack of greed is commendable. Your lack of interest is not. Don't you care what we own, what will someday be all yours? Here I can ride the land, move the cattle, and watch the water supply rise and fall with the season. I can't ride the lands of a station in northern Queensland." "As you know," she said, "in the last letter your father wrote to me, he told us how he had decided to sell off the stations and sugarcane plantations in Queensland. I intend to carry out his wishes." Tolo shrugged. "I must go up to Sydney again." The tone of her voice put him on guard. He was perfectly content to stay on the station, at least until the time was right for him to travel to Western Australia to begin his field study of the Aborigines of the Great Sandy Desert and the Outback. She was, he knew, going to ask him to go to Sydney with her. Tolo immediately felt a push and a pull. Here on the station, in the saddle, while working with the stockmen, he had no worries. It was a life he loved. In Sydney, he might see Java Gordon again, and he wondered about the magnetism he sensed drawing them together. "I'd like you to go to Queensland," she said. He looked up, frowning. "Through the estate agents, I have received estimates of the worth of the Mason Fisher holdings in Queensland," she said. "I've never even seen the properties themselves." She paused and felt the tears sting in her eyes as she remembered that she had in fact seen one of the Fisher stations, the one where she had first met John.